Software Engineering Radio Episode 18, Resource Management.
Welcome to a new episode of Software Engineering Radio. In this episode, I have invited a guest. My name is Michael and my guest is Prashant Jain. He's working for IBM Research in Delhi, India. Prashant and I have written POSA 3 together. That is a book on pattern-oriented software architecture. The topic of the book is the same as for this episode. It is on resource management patterns. So, Prashant, what is a resource in this context and how would you define it?
Well, a resource is basically any entity that is available in limited supply. And typically you would, the user for a resource would be an entity, for example, that acquires the resources, accesses it, and then finally releases it. And on the other side of it, there would be a resource provider. It is basically an entity that provides a resource whenever it's requested by the user.
Could you give some example resources that would fit in our scheme?
Sure. I mean, resources, I mean, again, since it's such a broad category, you can have all kinds of things regarded as resources. For example, memory is an excellent example of a resource. Similarly, things like threads, file handles, even processing time of a CPU is really a resource. And the key to note, though, is at least in our context, we are talking about resources which are from the point of view of really IT systems. And we're not talking about like other kinds of resources because, I mean, you can have non-IT types of resources also.
Okay, and so where's resource management really necessary? Why is that such an important topic?
Resource management is mostly necessary really to address the non-functional requirements, I mean, such as, for example, performance or scalability or even like stability and predictability.
So I guess resource management is important at almost every level, be it the OS level, the framework application level. In my experience, it's also important in almost every application domain, be it embedded systems or enterprise systems. So the motivation might be different for those systems. For example, in an embedded system, you might need first predictability and stability, whereas in enterprise systems, you would mainly require performance and scalability.
Exactly. In fact, it was basically given that background that we started when we started this writing this book, POSA 3. What we really did was we actually looked at existing software systems and tried to look for patterns. We'd actually mine patterns by analyzing different systems, and we tried to like come up with a list of generalized patterns. So, for example, like thread pooling is such a common thing which is used in so many system implementations. But the pattern behind it is much more general, which is the same pattern which is used when you start looking at something like, for example, connection pooling. And so we went ahead and we actually looked at, okay, what is the fundamental pattern behind these systems, which is really pooling. And that is something which leverages like basically best practices, and that is something that then we went ahead and we described as a pattern for resource management. And that's one of the fundamental patterns in here.
Okay, so how do we start on explaining the patterns?
So I believe patterns for resource management really fall into three broad categories. So you talk about patterns that deal with acquisition of resources. And once you have acquired the resources, there are patterns that deal with the life cycle of the resources. And finally, there are patterns that deal with how the resources are actually released back into the system.
Yes, and these patterns then together form a pattern language for resource management.
All these three categories together would really form that pattern language for resource management. So, I mean, just to maybe get started, perhaps we should look at, I mean, each one of these categories and look at some of the patterns. So, I mean, to give you an example, let's start with, say, acquisition of resources. And let's start with a very simple pattern. And let me try to motivate one of the most fundamental patterns by describing an example. So say like you're implementing a system that consists of, say, several distributed services. And now say like each service can actually, would typically say provide an interface which will be used by a client to invoke the service. So this is like such a common scenario, but the question is, how would the client actually go about finding this interface? And how does the client actually find it so that it can actually use it?
So couldn't just a service provider broadcast the service interface?
Yeah, sure, it could. But then the provider would still need to broadcast on a periodic basis because the clients can come and go, right? So see, the provider went ahead and broadcasted, but there was no client at that time. And the client really came like a little bit afterwards. So again, to make sure that the client actually gets that interface, the provider would then have to broadcast again, which means the provider really has to broadcast on a regular basis.
So couldn't the client just send broadcast messages saying that it is interested in a certain service interface?
Well, then again, you would have the same problem, because if there's no provider which exists at the time when the client is there, but the provider comes on at a later stage, so then in that case, basically, the client has to now periodically broadcast a message saying that it's looking for a certain interface. Plus, I mean, both like this one as well as the one where the provider is broadcasting, both these approaches really, I mean, it's leading to a proliferation of messages in the network. If you really think about it, I mean, as I said, I mean, so both these solutions are really, I mean, leading to a proliferation of messages, plus it's not a very elegant solution. So in reality, I mean, that's where one of the most fundamental patterns comes in, which is the lookup pattern. And the lookup pattern is really consists of a lookup service that allows resource providers to advertise resources along with properties that describe these resources. And plus then you have your actual clients who can then find these resources using these properties and then actually go ahead and then use them.
This sounds like a pretty fundamental pattern. There are many instances where lookup is used. I believe Corba naming and trading services are really implementations of lookup. If you talk about web services, UDDI is essentially a lookup service that allows publishing of web services. And also, well, it's not so common anymore, but Complus, in the concept of the Windows registry, is essentially a lookup service. Like also Eclipse. Eclipse has the plugin registry that holds plugins and extension points. So that is also an implementation of the lookup pattern.
Yes, you're right. I mean, in fact, as you mentioned, there's so many examples of lookup pattern. And in fact, it's really the pattern as well as a lot of its variants, which really form the fundamental building blocks of most distributed systems. And speaking of variants, in fact, like most patterns, lookup can also be implemented with some variations. So for example, a very common variant of lookup is really where the resources, for example, need not be registered by the resource provider, but it can actually be delegated to a third party. I mean, similarly, the resources can themselves, for example, register with the lookup service.
Those are interesting variations. So let's move on to talk about the next couple of patterns that deal with acquisition of resources. One of the most common ones is lazy acquisition. And In a general sense, this pattern is applicable to systems with restricted resources that must satisfy high demands, such as throughput and availability. For example, imagine a picture archiving and communication system in a medical domain that basically stores patient data, the whole history of a patient. And the data includes patient details, of course, like address information, but also all the digitized images and a typical solution, how you would represent those images would be to represent them as business objects to which you attach properties and all kind of additional information. But for a patient with a long medical history and several digitized images, fetching all the data, all the properties, and creating the corresponding business objects can take a lot of time. The problem here is how can the picture and archive system be designed so that the retrieval of patient information is quick, regardless of the number of images in the patient's record? So generally, the goal is to reduce the initial cost of acquiring resources. In this case, the resource is the memory needed for the business objects.
Well, I mean, couldn't you actually have, say, several threads which are loading the images in the background?
Yes, that is one possible solution. But what if the images are viewed only seldomly? It would unnecessarily consume processing time that might be needed by other processes.
So, I mean, what about not loading the images at all? I mean, why not let the user explicitly request them?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is just not actually user-friendly. I guess a user would expect that the pictures are available immediately without having additional clicks. But also, on the other hand, the user might not be able, and the screen might just be too small to display all the images. So this leaves some options for optimization. So if systems were to acquire all resources up front, a lot of overhead would be incurred, and a lot of resources would be consumed unnecessarily. So the general solution of the lazy acquisition pattern is to acquire resources at the latest possible time. So the resource is not acquired until it becomes unavoidable to do so. In our case, when the user really looks at the screen, selected the patient record, and wants to look at the first image. Typically, you would introduce a resource proxy that hides the lazy acquisition from the resource user. So in our case, again, we would have proxies for the images, and as soon as the proxies become viewable, become active, because they are in the view of the user, the system would load them on demand lazily. This would essentially save resources. A typical known use are again the Eclipse plugins, in which cases the descriptor is loaded on startup, but the actual implementation is then only loaded when the perspective, the view, is opened of that plugin. Another use case is ad hoc networks. In ad hoc networking, you have basically spontaneous interaction with services, and as you can potentially communicate with many services in a network, in an ad hoc network, you would load those services, those implementations on demand when actually needed, and would just evict them as soon as you don't need them anymore. The third use case, the third known use I want to give, is just-in-time compilations, heavily used by Java virtual machines, where the bytecode is just-in-time compiled instead of interpreted in order to achieve higher performance. And this just-in-time compilation is not done at startup for everything, but only for the portions that get actually executed.
In fact, as the name itself implies, just in time, it's really saying that, okay, well, it's only going to happen when it's actually needed. And there again, so essentially what it's doing, it's really postponing it or lazily carrying out the compilation at a future stage. So let me try to like really summarize what this pattern is all about. As you described, lazy acquisition pattern is really looking at, I mean, how do you actually save resources by really deferring the acquisition as late as possible and not really acquiring until you actually really need the resource. And by doing this, you can actually, save valuable, processing time or even valuable resources to make sure that you really only acquire them when you actually need them. So all this is wonderful, and as the examples you've given, they really justify why you would want to do it. But sometimes this is not what you may want to do. I mean, sometimes you may have systems or constraints because of which you cannot really delay the acquisition of resources until a later stage. So, for example, systems that need to be highly predictable. In such systems, you cannot really postpone the acquisition of resources. And for really handling such systems, you have a different pattern called eager acquisition, which, Michael, then I would now ask you to actually go ahead and then try to motivate and then try to describe.
Yeah, the eager acquisition pattern is applicable to systems that must satisfy high predictability and performance in resource acquisition time. And that is useful every time resource acquisition is expensive, and resource acquisitions for memory or threads and so on are typically expensive. So imagine you have an embedded telecommunication application with soft real-time constraints such as predictability and low latency in execution of operations. And well, in most operating systems, operations such as dynamic memory allocations can be quite expensive. So memory allocations are protected by synchronization primitives, typically because you want to ensure that the available memory accessed acquired from multiple threads is properly managed. For example, the memory management, such as compaction of smaller memory segments that got handed back on the release of resources, need to be again merged, compacted into larger memory segments, and that consumes time. So doing the management of released memory blocks and also protecting those actions through synchronizations makes dynamic memory allocation pretty expensive. The problem in the embedded system is how can you achieve predictable and fast memory allocations via operations such as new or malloc?
So you're saying basically that the general problem is that expensive resource acquisitions, such as dynamic acquisition of, like, say, threads or memory, so any of these can basically result in unpredictable time overhead. And so what we're really looking at is, I mean, how can you actually acquire resources from system which have, like, soft real-time constraints and still, I mean, fulfill these constraints? So, I mean, let me ask you, I mean, so why can't we just make acquisition itself faster?
That is a good idea, but in very most cases, we have no impact on the operating system, how that does its memory management, how it optimizes for synchronization. And so you just have no chance to interfere here. And the typical solution is here to introduce another layer that basically uses the eager acquisition pattern. And the solution idea is to eagerly acquire a number of resources before their actual use. Ideally, this time is at the startup of the system. You would acquire the necessary resources, and here, of course, you rely on some estimations or rule of thumbs how much resources you want to allocate here. And the resources are then kept in an efficient container from which you can acquire them later, fast, and in a predictable time. So coming back to the example, in this case, you would actually implement a simple memory pool with fixed-sized blocks of memory, which gets used only by a single thread. Why do I impose those constraints of fixed size blocks, and why only for a single thread? Well, if we have only a single thread, we can avoid the synchronization overhead, because even if we would manage the resources ourselves and we would have it accessed by multiple threads, we would still have some overhead. So we have a memory pool on a per thread basis that avoids the synchronization overhead, and we use fixed size blocks to avoid complicated compaction of used memory blocks.
An interesting example of this, I just thought of it, like earlier we talked about just-in-time compilers for lazy acquisition, but we also have compilers that actually do ahead of time compilation. And so this is basically, I mean, where they're looking at the JVMs, for example. They try to avoid compilation overheads during execution. So that's, I think, an excellent example for eager acquisition. Can you think of, like, other examples also?
Other examples are, for example, connection and thread pools, which would pre-acquire a number of connections or threads, respectively, to serve initial requests quickly.
Okay, so Michael, that's very interesting. I think what we have just talked about is lazy acquisition and eager acquisition. We've talked about, I mean, how under certain circumstances you may want to acquire resources lazily basically push back the acquisition. And in under certain circumstances, you want to acquire them eagerly, and so that they're available to you right at startup time. But what's a third scenario likely is where neither one of them is sufficient, and the resource acquisition itself is such a fairly intensive task that you may not want to acquire the entire resource in one go. That you may want to, like, for example, break it up into multiple chunks. And this is where a third pattern that we talk about in the category of resource acquisition comes in, which is partial acquisition. And in a nutshell, what partial acquisition really describes is a way of optimizing your resource management by breaking up acquisition of resources into multiple stages. And so what you do is, like, in each stage, you acquire a part of the resource. And so it could be, like, dependent upon system constraints such as how much memory you have. Based on that, you acquire a certain amount of the resource. Or it could also be, I mean, availability of other resources on which you have some dependency. And based on this, you basically decide how much you want to acquire. So overall, basically, what partial acquisition is talking about is dividing the acquisition into stages. And then again, how many stages you want to have, how much resource you want to acquire in each stage. A lot of these can actually be configured also. So this is what partial acquisition really talks about. Given these three patterns for resource acquisition, let's move on to the second category, which is that of patterns for resource lifecycle management. And there again, we have some very interesting patterns. And the first one let's talk about is caching. And Michael, I ask you to go ahead and then again motivate the pattern.
Yeah, caching is a pretty common pattern for optimizations. The caching pattern is applicable to systems that repeatedly access the same set of resources and need to optimize for performance. Performance is therefore the main motivation for this pattern. To motivate a pattern, I want to introduce a brief example. In a network management system, you would have many connections open to the individual network elements that you are monitoring. And the user would basically look at the elements regularly on or when there are specific events, and depending on that, new connections would be opened. And as soon as the job is done with this network element, he would go back, do something else, or just open the view on another network element. Here, the critical part is the regular opening of connections, closing connections, establishing connections regularly to a set of resources, but still on a regular basis.
If I were to really, I mean, I think understand or try to, like, generalize the problem, what we're really talking about is that like repetitious acquisition, or like say usage or initialization, and then eventually release of the same resource. I mean that causes a lot of overhead. And so the real challenge is, I mean, how can we actually reduce this repeated acquisition, access, and release cost of frequently used resources so that the performance is not hit? But the question is, I mean, if that's the case, I mean, couldn't you just keep the references in the application paths?
Yeah, possibly. But what about the resource consumption? You would end up maybe with thousands of open network connection handles. The pattern solution suggests to temporarily store the resources, in this case the connections, in a fast access buffer called cache. And you would use the cache to fetch and return the resources instead of reacquiring it from the original resource provider. In most situations, this is the operating system. And the cache identifies the resources by their identity. So in our case, it would be the destination IP address and port. But it is also common to use a pointer, a reference, or any or primary key to identify uniquely a resource. And so coming back to the example, you would implement a connection cache where you would drop the used connections that you don't need currently, and would just hope that you don't need to reacquire it from the operating system, establishing the connection, etc. The next time you visit a network element, but that you can just look up the connection in the cache, that it's still available, not evicted yet, from the cache, and so you save processing time and you avoid unnecessary delays. Some of the frequently used variants of caching is, for example, a transparent cache that you as a resource user or application programmer would not actually notice that it's in there. It would be the access to the resource provider, the operating system, would be hidden by a proxy, and so you don't know actually whether the resource is allocated, acquired directly from the operating system, or whether the cache kicked in. Some heavily optimizing caches are read-ahead caches, and read-ahead caches would guess, well, if the resource user wanted to access that resource, he might also want to access this resource. One of the known uses of caching is a web proxy, and a web proxy is a proxy server located between the web browser and a web server, and the web proxy is basically accessed instead of the web server, and it can then cache pages, web pages, and returns them when they are accessed a second time. For corporate networks, this is typically what is done to save on internet traffic and just get faster access times to web pages. Another known use are .NET datasets, where you would acquire from the data storage the data, keep it in a dataset, and then you can manipulate that dataset in your local cache, and as soon as you're ready, you would return or persist the data set again.
So I believe, Michael, I think caching, again, is another one of those fundamental patterns which is used extensively in most systems that where, for example, you want to make sure that a resource is available whenever you need it, and so you basically put it in a fast access buffer, which is what we're calling as a cache, and that you can access this resource again at a later time whenever you need it. And obviously, when you don't need that resource anymore, you can always release it from the buffer. So a very, very closely related pattern to caching is pooling. And there are a lot of similarities between caching and pooling. And a lot of times, there's also confusion related to whether you want to use caching or pooling. And a pooling is, again, it's basically looking at keeping resources in some kind of a buffer to avoid having to recycle them. But the key difference between caching and pooling is the identity of the resources. Whereas in the case of caching, the identity is very important because that is what we use to fetch a specific resource from this buffer. In the case of pooling, it doesn't matter what identity these resources have. So once you have used a resource and you release it to this buffer, the resource actually loses its identity, so that it can be later on when it's fetched again from this buffer, it acquires basically a new identity altogether. So typical examples when you talk about, for example, thread pooling or connection pooling, the resources in these cases, like threads or connections, these resources don't have any identity when they're put back into this this buffer or this pool. And so this is like the key difference between pooling and caching. Let's move on to another very interesting pattern in the area of lifecycle management of resources. And let me talk about try to motivate the pattern by describing an example. So say again, we have a distributed system that consists of multiple nodes. And let's say that all the nodes of the system need to be frequently updated. So it could be, for example, you want to have some patches and have these patches be installed on all the nodes of the system. And now let's assume that if one of these nodes fails to get updated when you're trying to do, say, a patch update, then the entire system basically can enter an inconsistent state. So the question is, how do you ensure that whenever you want to do this upload of the patch to all the nodes, how do you ensure that either all the nodes or all the subsystems are successfully updated or none of them are?
That is an interesting problem. Couldn't each subsystem communicate with all the remaining subsystems to indicate that they have successfully performed an update?
Well, yes. I mean, that is possible, but then such a point-to-point really communication among the subsystems, I mean, that would actually require that all subsystems be aware of each other, which is typically not practical. I mean, also, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, such a solution really is not scalable. I mean, as like the number of subsystems increases.
So what's a better way to do that?
Use the coordinator pattern. And so what the coordinator pattern really is, it's an entity that is responsible for execution and completion of the complete system update. So what we do is we introduce this component called the coordinator, and then what happens is that the task that is to be performed by each subsystem, we split it up into two parts, into two phases. The first phase is really called prepare, and the second one is called commit. So in the first phase, coordinator asks each subsystem to prepare for the work to be done. And if this phase is successful, then the coordinator goes ahead and initiates the second phase, which is the commit phase, which is where the actual work is done by the subsystems. If the prepare phase fails, then the coordinator basically aborts the task and asks all the participants, or all the subsystems in this case, not to do anything.
Hold on. This sounds almost like the two-phase commit protocol used in distributed transaction processing.
Yes, you're right. This is, in fact, the two-phase commit protocol is really one of the most well-known examples of the coordinator pattern. But I mean, did you realize that coordinator pattern has many more known uses? So, for example, like in the case of Java authentication and authorization service, the login context actually serves the role of a coordinator. So in like Java Authentication Authorization Service, the login modules are really the participants that are coordinated by the login context. Another very interesting example, and this is actually from the real world, is where a priest actually conducts a marriage. So if you think about the priest as really a coordinator and the bride and groom as really the participants, then what actually happens is in the prepare phase, the priest asks both the bride and the groom if they agree to take each other to be their spouse. And only when both of them agree does the priest actually commit them to marriage.
Fascinating. I actually like those real-world known uses. They're just so much fun. I want to give also a real-world example for ego acquisition that we previously discussed, and that is a hamster. You know that little animal? And the animal would typically run around and fetch all he would find on fruits and would pack it into its cheeks, basically eager acquire the food, and then go back into its cage. And there it would then have fast access to its resources, to its food.
That's really a very fascinating, very interesting example. Yeah, but that is really acquiring resources in this case eagerly.
Okay, so now we talked about acquisition and access of resources. The third area, the third category is resource release. And here we want to talk about two patterns. The first is leasing. Prashant, do we mind explaining the leasing pattern?
So let me try to motivate leasing with an example. So again, let's consider, say, you have a service which actually gives you stock quotes. And really, first thing you have to do is really get the reference of this service. And that you can find now using our lookup service, basically the lookup pattern we talked about earlier. But now consider what would happen if this quota service, or the service which is giving you stock quotes, if that were to crash and not come up again. So the reference for this service would be available with a lot of clients, and all these references would basically become invalid, and but these would still be available via the lookup service. So bottom line is, the reference which was published in the lookup service, that never got removed from the lookup service. The question is, how can we have this reference be automatically removed at the lookup service, given the fact that this service is no longer available? So to really, I mean, talk about as a more like as a general problem is really where we're talking about resources that are not used by a resource user, or is basically no longer available. How can we automatically free such resources so that and make them available to new resource users?
Couldn't you just have the clients access the lookup service and then have the clients access the stock quote service and let them fail?
Well, yes, you could. But again, you have two problems with it. The first problem is clients which already have the reference, which they got from the lookup service, when they try using it, that's when they would realize that this is an invalid reference. So it's not a very elegant way to basically find out that the reference is no longer valid. But a more serious problem is that that reference is still registered with the lookup service. So even if the existing clients which have the reference, they figure out that the reference is invalid, what about new clients? New clients are still going to go up to the lookup service, and they will still get back the same reference, which is now invalid. So the basic problem we're trying to solve is there any way by which that reference registered at the lookup service is automatically removed because it's now invalid? And this is where the pattern that we are going to talk about, which is leasing, comes into the picture. And so the concept is quite simple. We talk about introducing a lease for every resource that is held by a resource user. So when a resource is actually granted by, in this case, the grantor, and it is obtained by a holder, the lease then specifies a certain time duration for which the resource user can hold the resource. So going back to our example, the resource user in this case is really the lookup service, because it has been given a resource, which is the object reference, which it is holding for a certain period of time. Now, if the resource itself, or if the lease is not renewed after a certain period of time, then the user should automatically release that resource. So going back to our example, this quota service we had, the reference registered with the lookup service. If the quota service were to crash and not come back up, its lease would eventually expire at the lookup service. And if that lease is not getting renewed by the quota service, the lookup service should then automatically remove that reference. And once that reference is removed, it is no longer available to the clients. And so that actually helps solve our problem.
And I guess it's a pretty interesting question, or tough question, actually. Who then prolongs the lease, whether the resource itself notifies the resource user, or whether the original resource provider triggers the resource user that it needs to prolong the lease. I guess there are all kind of variants here.
That's correct. Then you're absolutely right. I mean, you can have many of these different variants, and but the bottom line is one way or the other, you have this concept of lease getting expired, and that resource basically no longer being valid and needs to be released. And in fact, if you think about, there are quite a few known uses of leasing. For example, .NET remoting. So like remote objects in .NET remoting are actually managed by so-called leasing distributed garbage collector. Similarly, in the case of DHCP, which is like dynamic host configuration protocol, there's a concept of a DHCP lease, which specifies the time for which the server is granting permission to the client to use a particular IP address. Another very common use of leasing is really for web-based email accounts. So a lot of the web-based email accounts, for example, like MSN, Hotmail, they become inactive automatically if they're not used for a certain period of time. And if a user actually uses it during this period of time, then the lease is automatically renewed. So this is, again, something which is happening in the background, and you're not explicitly renewing the lease, but the fact that you're using the account automatically leads to the lease getting renewed. So as you can tell, there are quite a few very interesting known uses of leasing.
Okay, so this has been leasing, one of our two resource release patterns. The other pattern is evictor, and evictor is a pattern that is also used in conjunction with other patterns like caching and pooling. But Prashant, so what is the evictor pattern actually about?
Sure. So Michael, as you mentioned, evictor is really used in conjunction with some of the other patterns we talked about. So let me try to, in fact, refer back to one of the descriptions we were talking about, which is that of caching, where we said, well, eventually, if a resource is no longer needed, it ought to be removed from the cache. But the question is, when would you know that the resource should be removed from that cache or from the buffer? So again, let me try to give you another example, which is basically a distributed system where you have a large number of objects, and you want to keep most of these objects in memory to be able to access them quickly. But at the same time, if you keep too many of these objects in memory, That again can lead to be that can be expensive. I mean, it can lead to performance degradation. So the question is, it's a fundamental question, both in the earlier example related to caching, as well as this one. How do you decide which objects to keep in memory? So how do you strike the balance between keeping objects in memory for efficiency and at the same time trying to reduce the number to minimize performance degradation? And this is basically where we bring in the evictor pattern. And really what evictor is, we're talking about, again, a component which monitors the use of resources. And then, given the use of resources, it then controls the life cycle of the resources using one or more strategies such as LRU, like least recently used. And based on these strategies, the evictor selects certain resources and evicts them, or basically removes them or releases them. And going back to the example we had for in the case of caching, if we had the evictor as a component, it would basically monitor the use of these resources related to the cache, and it would identify the resources which are not being used as much, and it would evict these resources from the cache.
And in the case of pooling?
So pooling, again, we can have a similar use where pooling, since we don't have the identity of the resources, but we are just dealing with the sheer number of resources in the pool, in the end, based on the how many of the resources are actually getting used, we can actually grow or reduce the size of the pool. And there again, when you're reducing the size of the pool, you can use the evictor to really evict the resources.
Okay, so we are through with our patterns on resource management. We went through a list of selected patterns from the book. In the book, we have some more patterns on resource management. If you're interested in more patterns on resource management, we suggest to skim through the book. Prashant, anything final to say?
Yeah, so I just want to add, so as Michael mentioned, first of all, this is really a selection from selection of patterns from the book. But this is, again, one thing to keep in mind is patterns as well as pattern languages is always, it's an ongoing work. So there are likely to be additional patterns related to resource management that either we may discover or others may discover. But what's interesting to, again, note is that, broadly speaking, the patterns really fall in these three categories. And as we discover more patterns, we would like to hear back from listeners so that we can again update this pattern language and to make it much more comprehensive.
Okay, so thanks, Prashant, for joining us for the show, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye, thanks.
This was another episode of Software Engineering Radio. The Software Engineering Radio team wants to thank Henning Pauli for providing the music, as well as Libsyn.com for hosting and bandwidth. For more information on the podcast, past episodes, and feedback, go to se-radio.net.